Should we just wing it?
He's a bit of an icon, isn't he? He's a bit of an icon of climbing. I think those like sport glasses he used to wear are like proper like icon.
Yeah, he's an iconic character.
Yeah, for sure. Like, I think particularly whenever I see anyone in like those kind of glasses, I think of Ben.
Yeah, yeah. Kind of from an era of climbing legends as well.
Yeah, and, yeah, definitely. And like being... We're basically doing the intro now, aren't we?
we can just introduce it. We'll just keep the ball rolling. Yeah, an iconic character, very influential in the early days of development in now very popular areas such as Ticino and Magicwood.
And Rocklands as well. He was involved in Rocklands, wasn't he?
Rocklands as well, yeah. And in more recent years has embarked on a relatively solitary endeavour, travelling to a remote part of India, into the Himalayas, Raksham, where he has discovered a vast boulder field and immersed himself with a very kind local community and has kind of almost taken his learnings from the development of all these other areas and cultivated what sounds like a really beautiful project out there, really trying to... it feels like it has real themes of like, yeah, respect for the local community and like seems to really be putting in the work to make a pretty magical space accessible to all.
And we've said before in this podcast about how sometimes bouldering is seen from the outside as this like adventurous activity, but actually the reality of it is people are mostly staying in nice Airbnbs, eating nice food, driving a car around, then get on a plane and go home. And there's actually incredibly little adventure left in it, but that doesn't have to be the case. And I think that's exactly what he's done up in Raksham, because it's still right in the Himalayas, with a community of people who aren't used to tourists or people from the West coming to visit. And so those two things combined with the community in the Himalayas and the altitude and everything, it really brings a lot of adventure back into the sport, which I think is the thing that I think is most exciting about it. That's the thing that tempts me in the most, to be honest. It's that feeling like it would be a bit of an adventure, not just for the granite boulders. I mean, obviously, as a granite boulder enthusiast, I'm very glad the granite boulders are there, but that isn't the main thing that would like draw me there. It's the other
almost side. The unknown is quite interesting, appealing in itself.
Yeah, he's absolutely he's a totally iconic climber, and it was great to chat to him.
Thanks for listening. Thanks for listening. If you're interested in further supporting the podcast, keeping this show on the road and also ad-free, you can also consider signing up to our Patreon account.
We've got a couple of tiers on there. We've got one tier which gives access to a bit more material. I'm actually putting more stuff out there now, so a bit more of like the full kind of unedited podcast. So there's a bit of extra material of Aiden and I stumbling over our words and rambling, but also a couple of extra episodes which are only for patroons. I've got some more ideas for those, and also it's the best way to keep up to date with what Aiden might be doing, because we get a little bit of sneak previews of some of Aiden's hard projects. There's currently one that went up this week of a little bit of a video of Aiden's Helvellyn project, which is going to be incredibly hard, and as of yet is only available on the Patreon. And there's also a Discord for the second tier up. So if you fancy that and getting a little bit of a heads up on who's coming on the podcast, suggest questions and just chat climbing with a bunch of nice climbing folk, then there's that as well. If you're enjoying the podcast and would like to support us, check out the Patreon.
Thanks for listening.
When were you in the UK?
Oh, I was quite a few times. I was thinking about it today. I was very early, maybe 20 years back in 2003 or so, 2002. I was lucky. I was climbing with Ben and Jerry and with some Austrian friends in the peak. So it was really a cool time there. And then I came back later for bowling, but we always catch the bad weather and a little bit highballing. And then I came back with Beat Cumberland. We tried some tread routes, but then I got sick, and then I met Johnny Dawes. So I stayed a few days with Johnny and climbed with him in the slate in the oven, he was saying.
Oh, wow. Wow, he's quite a character, hey?
Yeah, it was a crazy person to meet, but also very beautiful. Like we were really lucky to discuss and climb with him, and he showed us his roots or his crazy slabs, like they're very big and very small, and some other things. We had some really good discussions. I loved it.
Yeah, yeah, he's quite the climbing philosopher, isn't he?
Yeah.
Oh, it sounds like you climbed with lots of like the British legends.
With Jerry and Ben, yeah, that was really lucky. Like I came with Gerald Törhager, which is a good friend of them, and he's a good friend of mine. So they showed us around in Sheffield, and I think we did also a little partying in Sheffield. And we did some footage for a movie, like it's a really old, it's on DVD. I don't know what was the name. Oh. I actually forgot. But there's some footage, old footage from us with Ben and Jerry climbing in the peak.
Oh, amazing.
We'll have to track that down.
Yeah, there'll be relics, those DVDs.
I will check with my friends. I don't know why I don't get the name of the movie. It's called No Comment. It was one of the first climbing DVDs, maybe. No Comment.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I haven't even heard of it.
Yeah. Yeah, wow. Actually, you're not from the DVD time, so I'm still... I still have some DVDs here, so if you have a DVD player, so thank you.
Yeah, they'll be in high demand, these ones now. Or people will be on the search. Oh, that's quite amazing. And was that at a time when like Ben and Jerry were also visiting Switzerland as well? Because it's a bit of like an exchange of climbing on each other's developed local areas.
I think they came for bouldering then later, but I didn't meet them in Switzerland, actually. I don't know why. But they came to Zillertal a few times. But in Switzerland, we did not meet. So, since Christmas, I'm in contact with Ben, and I invited him for the Himalaya. So maybe he actually sponsored a moonboard for the Raksham Climbing Club in the Himalaya.
Oh, he did. Oh, that's great. I heard you saying that you'd asked him. I'm really glad that's happened.
Yeah, no, it's really cool. And so I invited him if he just want to go for a bouldering trip or climbing trip to India one day.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
that's quite incredible. I did actually want to... I did really want to dig into Rackham and that area in India because, well, I wondered if you could explain a bit of your relationship with the place because it's my understanding that you've been there most years for quite long trips the last few years anyway.
Yeah, since 13 years I go there, I've probably spent 4 years of my lifetime in this village already. So in 2010, it was the first time, and since I go every year, I spent 2-3 months in this valley for climbing.
Wow, it must be like a second home.
Yeah, it is. I'm actually right now a little bit homesick. Yeah, no, it's so much rock and the people. I just fell in love with India and this valley especially, yeah.
And what drew you to first visiting India? Because if I'm right in saying it wasn't a developed area before you went, right?
No, there was no development. I just wanted to see actually the Himalayas one day because my uncle was going for the 8,000 meter peaks, and I always got these little presents from Nepal and Tibet. So I was always curious about Himalaya, and I thought Himalaya must be so many boulders. Like, we know the Alps, so there must be some crazy valleys up there. But it was hard to get information. Like there was not so much news around. And then I was actually in a guidebook from English people have been trekking long time ago, like in the 50s already in this part of India. And there's an old trekking book, and there was a picture with the skyline range, like with the big mountains. And I saw this like a, it looked like a big wall. And then I thought, okay, if there's so big walls there, so there must be some boulders on the ground. And just out of that curiosity, I convinced Fred, Nicole, and Elie Chevieux. We checked another part of India for some boulders, which was okay, was also good. But I convinced them to go and have a look at this valley. And yeah, we found it. And the morning we wake up and we're just surrounded by rocks and boulders. And it's an amazing place.
What's the scale of it? Like, how big of an area does it have the potential to be?
It's not like the Cedarburg Mountains in Rockland, but it's hard to say. The valley, maybe it's 20 kilometers long, 30 kilometers long. Or let's say it like this. Val Bavona, I need 2 or 3 days, so I checked most of the boulders. Let's give it a week, then you know most of it. In Raksham, I'm running around now for 13 years, and I'm sure I didn't see all boulders yet. So there's so much rock, I will never see all of them. It's not possible. I think it's really huge.
Wow.
It's a concentration of boulders. Maybe you can't, for sure you can't climb on all boulders, because sometimes it's in a chaos also. But there's a whole hillside on the south side. We just started developing there. So we are more on the north side now. And if Raksham would be busy one day, I already know another spot in the valley. You start from zero, the same. It's really big.
Wow. But before we dig into too much into the place itself, I was quite interested. You've traveled a lot around the really high quality boulding areas around Europe and around the world. There's almost like a world where there's a guarantee of quite fruitful climbing trips. Like, you can go to places and know that you'll definitely find high quality bouldering. And then to go somewhere like this, you don't know what you'll find. There's no guarantee that there'll be any good climbing, or like there could be a lot of rock and the quality of the rock is all terrible and there'll be like no climbs at all. There's quite a lot of risk, and then there's quite a lot of effort that gets put into this trip. Like, what was it that drew you to this kind of adventurous style of just go somewhere like radically new, completely different culture, like totally unknown?
Maybe just because of the adventure and of seeing new places. Like, for me, climbing and bouldering, what drew me into climbing was not just the climbing itself. For me, it was leaving my place. Like, I grew up in a little village in Tirol. You never really get out of that, maybe in the valley. And climbing gave me the opportunity to see other valleys, other countries, other places. And I always liked this adventure part. So I went to Peru in 2010. We got even lost in Peru. But at the end, we found also some good boulders later. But it was just a super adventure trip. And it's a few weeks of the year I was always lucky, let's say it like this. But if I don't find good boulders, I still would have it's an amazing travel just to go into the Himalayas and see people living there and the villages and the mountains. You feel really small in the Himalaya. But maybe climbing was really traveling, and adventure was very important for me always.
Yeah, it is. I've thought about that more in recent times as well. It's very easy to live what looks from the outside as quite like an adventurous lifestyle, because you travel around to these new climbing places, but you can do it in a within your own boundaries of what is like familiar. You can operate traveling and climbing without ever really it feeling too adventurous. It's like almost like an attitude as well.
yeah. I love this attitude. I don't really plan everything. Like, really, when we went there, it was an epic trip. Like, at the end, the taxi driver did not want to drive further because he didn't know the valley. And my friends were also kind of getting sick in the car. They did not like to keep on driving. But so I pushed them a little bit, and even the taxi driver, to keep on driving, because we already were so far. Like, we drove 12 hours that day. into these mountains, and we didn't see anything yet. And after 12 hours, my friends looked at me and said, Ben, you're sure? And said, no, let's go. And then it was getting dark anyway, and we had to find a shelter. And we passed some boulders in the night then, and I thought, yeah, there's at least some rock. But in the morning, we woke up and saw we are in the middle of these rock fields. So it was a really lucky strike.
Yes. <Wow. laughs> You really needed that vindication after that drive.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. That's a nice intro. Like, was the quality of the place immediately obvious when you woke up as well? Like, was it?
Yeah.
It was quite apparent.
Because it's granite, and when you see the big walls, like, I have a little bit of geological background, and because I studied geography and geology a little bit. So when there's so big walls up there and looks like granite, you can be pretty sure you find some stuff. But that we find so many boulders we did not expect. And I knew just by the amount of rocks, it's the same what I was saying just before. I knew I will never see every line in this valley, probably, because it's just too much. And then it's the exploring of all these little boulders, which is also adventurous. Like, I spent hours running around in these villages or in these forests and in these mountains. And every exploring tour is the same kind of adventure when you look then for the line which motivates you or gives you motivation at the end.
Mm-hmm. And what's the community like around there?
It's a small village, maybe in the heart of the village are 400, 500 people, but it's a bit spread out with some other houses. It's right on the border to Tibet. So it's a mix between Hinduism and Buddhism, but people are more, it's Buddhist place, I would say. And so people are very heartful people, and they're welcoming. Now, they don't harm men or animals. So and you feel when you travel in those places, like, that's maybe a reason I like the Himalayas so much, because you feel so connected to their spiritual guidance. And they don't, you see in Europe, we have so much shit talking about other people and the greed, and you don't feel this in these places yet. So maybe it's coming with business and money. But when you see those old people and their eyes, they're poor people, like, compared to us, but they have a deep smile on their faces and in their eyes. And it's really nice to see how confident they are and how happy they are with this basic lifestyle, actually.
The simple life.
Yeah, a simple life. And it takes it what is important. And this is being nice to other people, supporting each other, and trying to make their living there. Like, they live there, it seems they live there already for thousands of years. And North India is not, like, those people are not really Indian people, because I think these people all came from Tibet or Nepal over the passes, and because Indian people would not have been able to live on 3,000, 4,000 meters. And in Tibet, it's normal. The whole Tibet is nearly on 4,000 meters. So you see also on the faces, it's not India really, it's more Tibet, I think.
Obviously, you're quite a regular there now. Do you feel like they've accepted you into their community quite well?
By now they really like me. I know everybody in the village. I probably know every person knows me in the valley, because with this project, and I bring always nice people normally with me. But at the beginning, they were a little bit suspicious, like, they did not know what we do. Like, they followed us into the forest and checked what are these guys doing. Well, we are brushing boulders. Some of the boulders you have to clean. And then they thought we are digging something from the rocks, which they don't know, which is some worth, some, like, looking for crystals or some stuff. But at the end, we were just cleaning dust from the boulders that we can climb them. And then we explained it to them. My job is climbing on rocks. And then they said, okay, if this is your job, then please come all the time. We have thousands of rocks around here. So, and we always have been very respectful. We asked where we can go. And so I think we they welcomed us to Raksham. And there are all lovely people up there. It's really beautiful just to be there.
Do they like the idea of potentially one day there being quite a few climbers going to visit, or they have a bit of trepidation towards that?
Actually, they pushed me. They wanted to have more tourists because they see in tourist is coming, it's growing. It's the first, I was kind of the first tourist anyway in the village, like as a foreigner. They didn't see many foreigners before. And then they said, I should bring more tourists because it's money. And then I told him, yeah, how many you want to have? Yeah, like, just imagine 100 climbers running around in the village. And they're not prepared. There's nothing. There are no rules. I think then it would be, could give problems. So then we started thinking about how to make this project, or how we can actually publish that place that everybody can benefit. But we keep it quiet for many, many years till we finally thought, okay, tourism will come anyway. It makes no sense that I try to keep it quiet or not publish it. So I thought climbing and adventure people actually is a good tourist to go there. Better than the Indian mainstream tourists will also start or is starting in the last 5 years. So I think climbers are very welcome now.
Have the locals there, have they been interested in climbing as well?
Yeah, yeah. They were joined and watched us. And now actually I started a climbing club in the village, the Raksham Mountain Adventure Club. So nice. I always try to climb with the local people or to bring them into climbing. And now they're really motivated, like 4 boys from Raksham. They climbed now for 3-4 years with us, and we sent them to a mountain guiding course. We paid it with our permit, so those guys could make the Indian mountain guiding course. So they try to climb now more and be more in the mountains. And the moon boards we probably will set up near the school with the teacher, so that the younger kids can also try climbing. And well, maybe one day the strongest climber comes from Raksham. Let's see.
yeah. Well, yeah, they'll have grown up in the right place for it.
Yeah. But it's difficult for those people also because they don't have this leisure time idea. They either work for their land and their country, and in wintertime they just don't do nothing. And the young people now go to school. But climbing as a sport, or leisure time, it's probably still takes some more time that it's growing. But the Indian climbing scene is growing. So let's see. And they did not even know what you can do with these rocks. And I was just climbing with the kids in school. They all love climbing. And those kids are so natural talented. When you see it, I took some kids the first time. I think I sent them into some 6A slavish stuff. They climbed it. Just because of their natural, these are mountain people. It's really amazing. Mm. The technique they have, or how easy they move. So it was really cool to see.
And have you set up or considered setting up any kind of safeguards to try and prevent it from getting kind of too popular?
Yeah, now we pushed it. With this movie, I did with Adidas. We published it, but we put up some guidelines, let's say it like that, together with the people from Raksham and the climbing club. And these are only guidelines, but the village people could, like, if it's getting too busy at one day and they feel disturbed, then they can say stop. And it's also limited because there's not so much sleeping space right now in Raksham. Maybe 50, 60 people right now can have a very comfortable accommodation. But it's growing. Like every year, more people are making our houses or making homestays. So at the end, the people of Raksham can decide, okay, now it's too full, it's too much. Or maybe they are happy because with the guiding system, it's a little bit income, a little money. And with the people, I put also up a permit system there. So we foreigners, we pay a little bit of a permit Some people say it's high. I think it's like I pay 100 euros when I go to the village into the climbing club. And my friends did the same. So we had this, have a good amount of money now. And so we sent those four boys to this mountain guiding course. And we can also support some local projects in the village, like even if it's something happened in the school or the nursery station. So, and with this, we just bring positive vibes for the whole village. So they see not only the hotel owner and the restaurant is earning money from the climbers and is super happy, and the rest is not involved. With the climbing club and this system, the whole village has profits a little bit.
How does the permit system work? Is it for the season, or is it per week or day or something?
Yeah, I must just check how they fix it up. Like we did it for a season. Like a season would be 100 euros if you are a student. And if you don't have money, you can talk with these guys. Huh? They will not throw you out of the valley. It's not like Hueco tanks, or we don't want to have Hueco tanks, or that it's like or in Yosemite where rangers are running around and controlling it. It's 100 euros for the whole season. And I'm just checking for if you come for a week, Mark, then give what you want. Give them 10 euros, 20 euros, but just support it somehow. And for Indian climbers, it's just 100 rupees, like this, a euro per day.
Nice. No, it's really lovely, because it does seem like, because you've been involved in the development of so many areas which are now really, really big and really, really popular, it feels like you're trying to kind of learn from where some of those areas went wrong, and you're pouring all of that, all of those lessons into trying to get this one right. But for the people as well, it's quite obvious to see, but it's really lovely. And it's trying to make climbing be positive to the locals, because that's where climbing sometimes goes wrong. And that's when it all sorts of fall apart. And next thing you know, they're, you know, banning, and the area's getting closed down and things.
Yeah, I think we just have to think about some stuff before we publish a place. And then, yeah, get it ready with the locals and the people, then the places don't get closed later. Yeah, I think it's because the climbing is so big now, I think it's just something we should really always consider and think about. Depending on the place, when it's just a few boulders somewhere, you can keep it quiet. But everything you publish, and when you see Raksham and the potential, so I was just really afraid that we destroy the nature there too. But when you see those forests, and it's so lovely, and I just thought, wow. If I go there one day and this forest is fucked because of us climbers, then I have a problem with myself. So it's same like I always bring the example of magic wood, but I loved magic wood. Like I spent every 3 minutes of my life back then in this forest. And when I go there now, it hurts a little bit when I see the changes. And so We just try to make something different now in India. Yeah.
It feels like you've really cultivated like a certain respectful attitude with the people there, and hopefully the place as well. I was going to ask you about, because you were, of course, a big part of the development of lots of very popular areas now in Ticino and Magic Wood, like you say. And like these are areas which maybe we're beginning to see the detrimental impact of a lot of climbers there. And I almost wonder whether the downfall of that is the attitude of the climbers and kind of maybe slightly losing their way as to like their impact on the landscape, or whether it is just solely the quantity of climbers and there's always going to be a mark left by people visiting. And it's just purely just a numbers game that we can't mitigate the impact so much. But I guess this is... kind of feels like you're taking some of the learnings from these areas and, like Sam was saying, applying it to a new place.
No, it's also like in Rocklands, I watched for so many years and I followed the discussions there also. And people tried to find a good solution for Rocklands. I think now it's pretty good. It's quiet since Corona. It's not so busy after Corona, but the years before Corona, the Rocklands or the African climbing community, they had it. It was very busy down there. And then when you see it's a nature conservation, it's a national park. And when you have seen roadside, it was really crazy to see it. But actually the problem was the national The park, they earn also money with the climbing, so they promoted it to earn more money, and they didn't really take care so much about it. But yeah, I tried to learn from the mistakes. We see what happened afterwards, and so I think we always can try to make it better.
I went to Rocklands the year after it had sort of reopened after the COVID stuff. And I hadn't been before, but people I were with had been. And they said it was remarkable how much the area had recovered in those 2 years. Like all the paths had shrunk back. And they said it actually looked way better than it had done a couple of years ago. And we've sort of wondered a couple of times about these really popular areas, because climbing's now so popular that there's going to be a huge amount of traffic. And like Magic Wood, for example, seems like an area to me that I've spent quite a lot of time there. I've never really seen people being super disrespectful, but it's just sort of been loved to death a bit. So I wonder if the best thing to do would be to take areas and just close them for, you know, be like next season, that area is fully closed, and give nature like a full year to recover.
Yeah. I think this is... I told them in Magic Wood they should do it, not even the whole area. You could have closed a few sectors in the forest, and then even the climbers would see how redeveloping it is in 1 year, how nature comes back. It recovers very quickly, like in Rocklands with the rain and the COVID, it looked amazing. And in Magic Wood, I tried that those people or the official people maybe only close one or two sectors. Then you would see it in another year, this place or the whole area. But that's going to be tough. I think many problems, many people will have problems with closing Magic Wood for a year.
Yes, no, and actually you're right. You can't close the whole area because there are like, you know, businesses that are set up around climbing areas, and you can't really tell a business owner that they can't have any business for a whole year. That sort of doesn't work. But you could, as you say, shutting off sectors, like a sort of zone defense. If you turned Magic Wood into like a quarter and then have one quarter was closed every year, I wonder how much of a difference that would make.
Yeah, I think it would be a really interesting case study, like some biologists, climbers could be doing some good work on that. But now, I don't know what's happening in Magic Wood now, so let's see. The campsite is very big and it's growing still. They tried to fix it in some small places, but yeah, I would close some sectors. And yeah, it's hard to say. Magic Wood looks for me wild. I think it's still magic, but you don't know how it looks like at the beginning. So it's hard. People still find it magic, and it still is. But at the beginning, it was a really fairy tale forest. Like we got lost. Still after 1 year, we got lost in this forest because it was so thick, like going through. And we found boulders 2 or 3 years later because we just hit another road. Or there were no roads, actually, but we always squeezed through those boulders. It's amazing how quickly it changed. But it's also the first sport area, bouldering area in Graubünden or in Switzerland. So it's concentrated at that spot. But I think it would be worth to keep an eye on that.
Yeah. And actually, bouncing back to Rackham, has it got to the point yet where when you go, you bump into other climbers that you didn't know were coming?
No.
Not yet.
Not yet. But this year, a few people came. A woman came from South Africa. I did not know, but I knew by my friend. No, actually. And we put up this website and I tried to help them. Like, there's this Raksham website. And when you are interested in, you send the mail and it goes directly to the climbers or to the people in Raksham. But I'm still, because I made the website for them, I can still check if they do the work or if they are answering. So I actually see. And my people can also always write me. I'm happy to give information because I have a lot of India experience now and I can always drop a line or send a message. So, but I did not jump into people I did not know yet. No.
This last summer season, Nikki Cheria, he joined you as well for the season?
Yeah, he joined me for 3 weeks or for a month he was there. Yeah, it was really beautiful to climb with Nikki or to show him the place.
Yeah, he spoke very highly of it as well, actually. He seemed to really enjoy the place.
Yeah, I hope he's coming back. There's still a lot of stuff to do. He liked it really a lot. Yeah, the beginning was not... No, he loved it. I showed him the best stuff, and I think Nicky also saw the potential of the place, and there's still a lot of things to do. It was really a great time. Just he got sick at the end, the last week, so that was a little bit sad.
Okay.
He was a bit afraid, so he went down to lower areas for recovering.
Yeah, because it's at high altitude as well, yeah.
Yeah, he just got a flu because he climbed too much. He didn't listen to my advices. So at the end, he just catched a flu. But when you catch a flu on 3,000 meters, it's more hard on the body than when you are down in our areas.
No, I used to travel a little bit to India when I was quite a lot younger with my family. And there was never a time that I visited and didn't get sick. Always at some point.
But, you have been more in the south, or did you go to the mountains?
No, in the north. And actually, the last time I was there, I did go into the Himalayas. I walked to the source of the River Ganges, the glacier Tapovan, and it was pretty amazing. But I hadn't discovered climbing at the time, so I look back on the photos now, and we'll see so many rocks in the background. So it's basically at the base of the Bhagirathi Peaks, and there is just like, there's loads of rocks, and I kind of see them right in the background of all the few photos that we take. We've never been very good at taking photos when we've been away as a family, but it's like tantalizing looking back on them now. And I was like, if only had the eyes I have now, I'd have probably
Then you have been actually close to Raksham, because the Shiva, like the Bhagirathi range and the Shivling and these mountains, they end in Raksham. This mountain range is the end of this, you can say. I could go from Raksham down to Shivling and to Gangotri. Take me 3-4 days crossing the mountains.
Yeah, we stayed in Gangotri before we walked up to the glacier. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Then you have been close already. And for being sick, I could give you some advices. Like all my friends, nobody got sick. When you just keep a few advices for the first few days, you can always get sick. But the stomach and all those stuff, none of my friends got sick in the last years. When you take care at the beginning a little bit, you will be fine, I think.
Yeah. It was always in hindsight. You make a mistake and you eat out somewhere, or like buy some fruit on the stall that you can see is clearly not very good, and you can always like pinpoint it back.
You have been in Gangotri. I didn't visit Gangotri yet, but there should be, I want to do this trek to Shivling, there should be some boulders, but on the Raksham side are many more rocks, I think.
Oh wow, incredible.
When's the sort of season? When's the best time to go?
I always go September, October, November, like end of September maybe, because now the weather pattern changed a little bit. Fall season, like same in Europe, fall season is very beautiful, and the friction, it's like fall in Europe. And you can also go in springtime. So maybe this year I go in spring, so April, May. So let's see. But a fall season is most beautiful. And well, I just had 3 months of perfect conditions, like 3 months, 5 days, no climbing because of the weather. So it was pretty amazing.
Mm. Yeah. What is the climate like there? Is it very cold? Or
when the sun is up in the Himalayas, it's always nice. Like when the sun comes up at 8:30 at the hotel or where I sleep, I can go with t-shirt and sit in the sun and have my breakfast. In the forest, in the shadow, in November, you have maybe 5 degrees, 10 degrees. And when you feel cold, you just go out in the sun and you have 20 degrees. It's like a little bit springtime. The sun is already, and in the Himalayas, the sun is always warm, but in the shadows, it's cold. So during the day, it was amazing conditions this year. The coldest time of the day comes when the sun goes down and you are in the hotel or in your accommodation. So there you need actually the blankets and all the clothing. But during the day, as long as the sun is here, it's amazing. I climbed till 19th of December with t-shirt on 4,000 meters this year.
Wow.
It's that's quite incredible. Believe, but it's no, it's because it's near at the equator, so this is the climate there.
And the air is pretty consistently quite dry as well, as I imagine.
Yeah, normally they have these monsoons, so you have July, August, normally, or June into August, you have monsoon time, the rain season. Then in September, the dry season starts till winter comes. And then they have, the winter is the second rain season. Then spring now, April, May should be fine. And then it's like monsoon, like they have twice a rain season and twice good weather season then.
And is it getting easier to get there, or do you still have to kind of poke a taxi driver to drive you 12 hours into the wilderness?
No, now the roads are much better. Actually, from Delhi, it's not such a big issue anymore. Like, most of the roads are now paved. You can go with bus, you can go with taxi as you want. Like, sometimes I travel the first part with night buses, and then a taxi picks me up. Like the last part, it's cool. If you are a very adventurous person, you can go with the local bus. I did that also, but now with the luggage, I take a taxi. They bring me. It's cheap. It's in India. And the taxi driver drives as I want to stop for a picture. You drink some tea. Like, you can really chill, go into the mountains. No, and there's even a bus from Delhi to Raksham, which goes nonstop 20 hours, but that's a bit rough of a travel. So,
I can imagine. Yeah, it's always going to be a more adventurous option, isn't it, than popping over to Ticino and renting a car. Yeah.
No, but it's part of the travel, like, because once you are there, you don't need a car, nothing. Like, once you are in Raksham, you stay there, the rest you can hike. You don't need a car anymore. And driving into the Himalayas, like coming from Delhi into the mountains and then up in the Himalayas, it's part of the travel. And it's very, stunning. Like, these mountains, it's double the size of Europe, the European Alps. So you feel also like that small. But you can make it in 2 days, like 2 days easy travel. And you go to Shimla, that takes you 8-9 hours from Delhi. You stay there, you chill, and good food. And the next day, it's another 8 hours drive. So then you are actually there. Doing it once, like last year, I did Switzerland, Raksham in 27 hours, non-stop trip. But I now know I'm too old for that. So next time I make a stop, I felt pretty fucked when I arrived.
Yeah, that sounds pretty terrible.
and what's the actual climbing like? Because it's granite, right?
Yeah, it's granite, but there are different kinds of granite in the same forest. So I don't know really why. I'm just reading some geological studies about this place. But we have a different kind of granite in the same forest and some outstanding rocks, which maybe must have came with glaciers because they don't fit completely into the forest. It's kind of Ticino and magic wood mix a little bit. It's more powerful climbing. A lot of, like, I think many time of your crimps, Aidan, there would be so many small crimps in this place.
Oh, nice.
And the cool, there's some black rocks. And they have like features, they look like they break, like just a few millimeters, but this is 100% solid bomber rock. It's really amazing.
Wow. Yeah. That sounds appealing, tempting.
Yeah. No. Maybe one day.
Yeah. Yeah. No, yeah. No, it's somewhere I'd love to travel. I'd love to revisit India because it's been many years since I've been, and I've always found it like culturally quite an amazing place.
Yeah, me too. Like, traveling or being in India is always very interesting. So then you have seen because Gangotri is really the Hinduism paradise, but backside it changes a little bit. And from Raksham, you could even go up to Spiti, which is the Buddhist place of India. Then Spiti is not far away. It's like a tip, And it looks completely different. It's like the Tibetan Hochplateau. And this is the Buddhist area then of India.
Oh, wow. Okay.
With some really old monasteries. Like, yeah, there's no Hinduism. There is only Buddhism then. It's so cool that you find everything in India.
Yeah.
They live so close together and they don't have problems until some politicians come and make it a problem.
Yeah. You've had you've shown the area to a few climbers, right? Because I know the film you released with Adidas was the one with Melissa and Giuliano as well. And that was quite a few years ago, maybe two or three years ago.
Yeah, it was 21, I think, we made the movie. It's only 2-3 years ago, yeah.
Ah, okay.
And Nikki joined me, and my people from all over the world came. Like, there were people from Kazakhstan, from South America. It was the craziest thing. And our crew comes from Copenhagen, Anders, if you hear it. I think he's patron at this podcast.
Oh, nice.
Yes. Okay. Yeah, we got a question from him then. I was wondering what that was.
So he came 2 years ago, and last year he came with some other people from Copenhagen. And yeah, they developed also a lot of new boulders and rocks, and we had a really good time.
It definitely seems it's been a pretty cool project developing a new area like that. And I was because I kind of know that you've developed a lot around Switzerland, and we've mentioned Ticino a few times, but I actually didn't know over what time frame or what consistency you were doing that. Is this when you really immerse yourself in an area and really explore individual areas? Is it something that you have always found an appeal for? Is Raksham a bit different to other areas you've done much bouldering development?
Different? No, maybe not really, but when it's a little bit different because it's so far away, but the reason I'm doing it also back in Switzerland, we had to look for boulders because there was only Cristiano with a few boulders. When I started bouldering and I went to Cristiano, I just knew maybe 4 or 5 lines with names and a number. The rest of we did not know. The whole Gironico was our playground. We did not have grades. We just went there and climbed. And with Steini, we just hiked and drove all Swiss valleys for looking for new boulders, because we live in Austria here on the border. We have some rocks, but it's not the best. We have some cool boulders but we wanted to find another. Ticino is good for winter, so we needed something for the other season. So we really constantly, we checked the computer or the maps. We looked for some rocks. We drove there and checked them if they are good. And if it was not good, we kept on searching for another place. Like with Steini, I drove nearly all Swiss valleys in the eastern part of Switzerland. Like, it was our leisure time. We drive around looking for rocks, and then we found magic wood and got stuck for many years.
just for clarity, are you a full-time professional climber?
Yeah, I was actually the last 20 years.
Okay, so that's been going on a long time.
Yeah, not maybe professional. At the beginning I was studying, to be accurate. At the beginning, I was studying and I did working on the side to get the money for the traveling. Then I did with Dreamtime. I got I got kind of famous, got some fame with that. But back in this time, the sport was so small. I was considered one of the best climbers in the world, but I think I got 2 pairs of shoes and 2 pairs of trousers at that time. So
nice.
I did not think that I will ever live or can live with bouldering, of course. So I keep on studying and working, but it developed perfectly for me with Adidas and Red Bull, and so it slowly I got a professional a few years later.
Nice.
But it's actually crazy that I know I did Dreamtime and some others. I was Boulder of the Year from the climbing magazine, and maybe I got 1,000 euro travel money, and two pairs of shoes and two trousers.
Yeah, it was fascinating talking to Ben Moon about this, because basically the money in climbing was actually quite good in the late 80s, 90s, early 90s. And it was good, and then it crashed, which is funny, because like he was saying, you know, in the early days, they were winning really good money doing the comps and things. But then the money just sort of sapped out of it. And it's funny how that seems to kind of come in waves.
It's actually interesting. I don't know why, because my friends also told them they had really good prize money and good sponsoring money back in the days. So maybe the companies have been very motivated, or maybe now they use it. I don't know, the money they use for something else. Too much management, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah. You mentioned briefly when you were talking about development of Chronico that initially when you were just going around all the boulders, they were kind of undocumented and ungraded. We've spoken about it a few times, just the idea of just a complexity around grading things in bouldering. There are potential limitations that it can like lead to our psychology around boulders as well. And I just thought it was interesting because, of course, Nikki, who joined you in Raksham, has like quite interesting philosophies around his climbing and chooses not to grade the climbs he does. And I thought it might be quite interesting when you've seen an area and developed an area where you have ungraded things, and it's since transitioned into maybe quite an area which people travel to. And it almost, not for everyone, it's an overgeneralization, but often can represent the side of bouldering where there's quite a collection of achievement. Switzerland is often a destination people go to do their projects. It can almost be of great emphasis on grades as a place. And like, I don't know, have you seen that transition and seen how like the psychology towards climbing has changed through that like attachment to grades?
I think I've seen and experienced these changes. For me, bouldering, because I actually come from sports climbing, like I was a good sports climber before, and the scene was very competitive, like how much, what do you flash? This you must flash. This is on site. This is for try. And I was part of that. But then in bouldering, it changed, because there were no grades in Ticino. Steini did not know. Like we knew 3-4 boulders. This is famous La Proue. We knew this with 8B. Dreamtime did not exist yet. And there was a Edel, La Grotte, Les Opiers. And maybe a 7C slab, and the rest was, our grading was, it goes not, and it goes maybe. So there was no focus on the grades at the beginning. And that's what I loved so much in this sport. You meet those people, everybody trying crazy projects or moves, but there were no numbers behind it. So I really liked it. And then the grading came a little bit later, I think, with the sponsoring, and people wanted to know, they started to compare it. But I loved the time when, because I still also find that the grades are so subjective. It's no grade will ever be really accurate. They are important for the media, but the grading system, I think it's not, now we only talk about the grades, so we lost actually, before we talked about boulders. When I was in Ticino and started bouldering, when you met a person, you went there, you had a shake hand, because you were kind of happy to meet another person, and you shared information. And he said, yeah, I cleaned something new there, you must try, there is something new. And then we told him about our development or what we did. So the grades were not so important at the beginning. And it was also hard to grade. I had no idea about the grading anyway. So why give a number?
Yeah, it feels a bit more playful. Like it's quite a nice attitude.
And in this game of playing, I noticed that I'm giving my best. Like when it was important, or I made it myself important, I should repeat something, or it's 8B plus or whatever. I lost my fun a little bit, because before I just was running around this. And if I see something which attracted me or I liked, or I said, wow, this shape, this looks interesting, I was fully in and give everything I had. And that's I did in Raksham again. So maybe Raksham was good to start, restart bouldering, because I did the same there. You just run through the forest and you look what you like and what attracts you or what you find beautiful. You clean it. And sometimes it's a hard boulder and sometimes it's just the easy boulder. But we also cleaned all the easy boulders. Like also in Magic Woods, people think I only did new baseline and some other stuff, but we cleaned all 7As, 7Cs and all grades. The numbers of them, we had to put in the numbers later anyway. I should now make 600 numbers for the Raksham guidebook. I'm working on a guidebook. And I should create now 600 boulders.
Wow, that sounds awful. That doesn't sound as fun at all.
Yeah, that is a rough gig.
It really resonates with me. I think I thought a lot about this when I was climbing with Nikki, and I really do respect Nikki's attitude towards it in many ways. And like, as you describe it, it makes me feel almost without the grade, it's like it's makes the things you try or the climbs you do feel very honest. I often think that it kind of removes one of the potentially many factors of why you could be trying the climb that are like different to you just want to be trying that climb because it's fun. Probably you hope the reason we're all like really keen climbers is because we love climbing, and there's probably a very like core part of our nature that we see a rock that looks really appealing to us and want to climb it. And then there are a lot of distractions which pile on top of it as well, which are neither good or bad, but like can somewhat confuse that message of just like wanting to have fun to climb a bit of rock. And I often think that grades, with like the media incentives and then that also being your livelihood and all of that, I don't know, I found for me personally anyway, like I often begin to acknowledge that it has an influence over my relationship with a climb, and it's not always in a way in which I'm happy about. Sometimes it has to be like an active intervention for me to like disassociate from the grade of a climb or another feature of a climb that is maybe different to just me being motivated and inspired by the climb itself.
I see it also. I think for you and this younger generation, it's so great how you talk, and because you, it's already obvious for you how to see it. But other people, I think I see many people just climb for the grades. Like their motivation is to climb this 8A or this 8B, and then they are happy. And what I try when I do a lot of kids climbing, I try to get them out of that number game and just say, just do what you like. Because when you have fun, I think out of fun and motivation, the highlights are coming. You probably climb above your grades just because you are so motivated or so psyched by this piece of rock and you just don't care what it really is. You're just into the climbing. And it got a little bit lost. I don't have a problem with the grades, and we will put up some grades for the guidebook, because a grade should be just a number so that people know what they try. The idea of a grade didn't really change. It was only, it comes from the mountain climbing, and people wanted to have to know the number that they don't get an accident or that they don't climb into the most difficult mountain. So there must be some grades that you know what you're going to do. So I will give them roughly 8A, 8B or whatever. And then future will see the numbers will come anyway. But I see it with kids, how when you just play without the numbers, how they react. And as soon as how hard is it and the numbers are here, they lose the concentration there. You compare a little bit. But I think every person can learn this. Maybe some people just start for climbing the numbers and then it will change later and also reverse maybe.
I think it's almost a bit of a luxury though, that if people really want to, you know, they're really excited to try and be, you know, I want to grow up and be a professional climber like Bernd, for example, then they need to use the grades a little bit to get them there. No one's going to kind of, that is kind of doing the big numbers and the big grades is what excites the media. And then you might get a sponsorship deal out of it. If you kind of let go of numbers from the start, you're probably letting go of your opportunity to be a professional climber as well, if that was your goal. Because if you don't say what the numbers are, the media, rightly or wrongly, won't latch onto you at all.
Yeah, that's for sure one of the reasons, I think, and hopefully more companies are changing in the future. But some companies already realize that this number chasing game, it's a little bit boring every day reading about this 8 A's, 9 A's. There are so many. It's like the news in the world. There are so many news every day we get into our heads. It's just full. And then climbing, I have the feeling it's a little bit the same. But I heard and talked with some company and people in the management, which they want to make a change. But the thing is, if they can make a change, that it's more about the story, about the person behind what you do. Because it's really boring. It's all these lists. It's the only thing. We reduced this whole fucking beautiful climbing stuff to a number at the end, which shows up in our ranking. It's pretty crazy.
Yeah, it's one of the kind of side effects, I think, of Instagram having become the kind of forum for climbing, because it has always limited you to 60 to 90 seconds. So and then a little caption. So it has kind of reduced climbing to kind of a video. All you've got time for is just a video of you doing the climb, and then you say the number, and that's basically it. Whereas I think what'd be really nice is try and kind of de-Instagram climbing and encourage more longer form content where people have a bit more of a opportunity to kind of go into a bit more detail than just the raw basics.
Yeah, it's right now, it's really difficult. Like you see Nicky, he climbed so many hard boulders and he is just fucking strong. But because he's not playing this number game, many young people don't even know him. Or for him, it's not so easy to get into the companies, I think, or to with the sponsorship, because there is no numbers. And nowadays you have managers. Back in the days, you often had climbers or people from the mountains sitting in the companies, I think, which saw your passion and your love for something. And maybe now you just have a manager and he's doing his job and he must do his job. And the easiest is this number thing. It's like mathematics. So, but there's a potential of change in there, because I hope the companies could change the whole game, actually.
And I think it's becoming more possible in that we're now coming into an era of climbing where climbing-based companies or climbing-owned companies are becoming big enough to support athletes professionally. Whereas, like, for quite a long time, I feel like it has been the companies that have been able to support climbers to like climb full time and be professional climbers haven't been at the core climbing companies. So like mostly it's apparel companies that generally will support climbers, and generally climbing aren't like the main market for those companies. So like they're almost not at the core climbing companies. And then so it's almost like unrealistic to expect that they completely get the essence of climbing. But I think we're now at a time where climbing is becoming big enough that there is value in managers really understanding the sport, and also just companies which are built by climbers being able to support athletes as well. So I feel like it is a time where there is the opportunity to change as well.
Yeah, I hope for that a little bit. I'm getting old. Like I'm getting out of this. I'm already one of the oldest sponsored people, so. And I'm for sure not. I'm not a market person, because you must be 20, 25 and look a little better.
Yeah, hope you got a few more years left in me.
Were you at any point tempted to not use a kind of formal grading scale for you could have potentially come up with your own grading scale that only was suitable for that area, for example?
Yeah, I had this idea, and we had actually the same for Magic Wood at the beginning. We had this great easy, moderate, difficult, and the hardest was Sau Schwar. So we really had this at the beginning when Chris Sharma was there and those people. He actually also graded like we did, but the numbers just came, huh? And then they stuck. And I was thinking about the same with Raksha, because it would make my work easier for the, this is going to be the guidebook.
Oh, nice. Wow. There you go. That's fun.
And I'm sure this is the biggest boulder in Raksha.
Oh, wow. That's amazing. So for people listening, is this a drawing that you did, Ben?
Yeah.
It's like it's pencil brilliant. Draw. It's a map, but it's done by hand. Wow, that's beautiful.
Yeah, I did. The whole area is made by hand. It's like we have 16, you see, 16 sectors. And now I try to put this in a book and see how it looks like.
Wow, that is, that's quite a special guidebook. I think you've got the personal touch.
This is the grading we have now.
Oh, nice.
Don't cry.
There's no numbers. But well, I talked with many people and friends and also with Anders, and they say I should make a rough grading, because otherwise people are not even interested in, like, when people don't know how many 7Cs and it is and whatever is there, people might not come. So maybe this whole project will never start. But I thought I don't grade, and then only people with some adventure heart will come anyway, and then they will be amazed. And when we are there, I always know roughly the numbers, or I will not send a beginner into an 8A route. Like, I know to which places I send people or to which boulders they can try. And we roughly have numbers. But all my friends told me I should grade. So what do you think?
I think it's complicated in that there's obviously a benefit to having the standardized grade system, which is universally, like, kind of understood, well, to a certain degree understood. Like you say, I think there almost has to be the real emphasis that these are like subjective, because I feel like often the grades aren't seen as subjective, but the real value of them, if you were to use like a grading system, which is relatively subjective, is it really does give guidance to people. And especially like in a place where people would travel a long way, and then Raksham, this is very applicable. They might see this guidebook and like see these climbs and be really inspired by them. And there's a comfort in knowing what you are being motivated by. So for example, if you were to be like climbing a 7C boulder and you see this picture of yourself on an amazing prow, and you're like, wow, I really want to climb that prow. That's amazing. And you had no idea of the grading scale. It turns out it was 8B+. And then like, it's quite hard to know. There's a real value in knowing what you can get inspired by and motivated by to try on a trip. But then at the same time, we obviously, well, like, we don't have to go into the complexities of the limitations of grading as well, of which there are many. But yeah, I kind of have juggled with that. It is hard to step away from, just because it's so universally accepted, I think. And that is one of the real values, I feel, of the grading system we have.
But do you think there's potentially another option, which is to go down the more like what they do on the indoor grading? We could have circuits. Oh. So not actually, you know, make official like font circuits, but you just have, you know, a set of colors and say red is like 7A to 7B or something. And they might even overlap. And that would also save you the hassle of trying to exactly grade 600 boulders. But, but like, what I like about grade brackets is that it allows, if people understand that you kind of say exact grading isn't possible. So it's like, it gives a little bit more wiggle room.
Yeah. Notice that's also a nice idea, like with the colors or the brackets. But at the end, maybe I will describe, I can give my numbers on these grades, and I will describe it like that. Like, my numbers are proposals. They will roughly be there. so that you know that if you want to climb 7C or 7A red, that you know, okay, I can go there. I want to try that. It should be in my range. So we have to give people these informations, yeah, because of the traveling and everything. So maybe either it's the color. I like the idea too, but then I have to color all the boulders. I think I have to stick.
Yeah, any way you slice it, there's a lot of work that needs doing. Yeah. But yeah, you're right. The last thing you want is people going on a huge long trek up to a boulder which turns out to be 8 grades too hard for them. Like, there's no one wins out of that.
Yeah, no. We want to make it. We give those informations that people can have a great trip and enjoy it, and also enjoy the climbing in whatever grade they are interested in.
I do feel optimistic that there is a healthy middle ground here. I very much appreciate that myself and many other sponsored climbers operate within a system where, like, there is credibility and, like, validation in doing climbs with these numbers associated with them, with Instagram being like the forum for climbing achievement. That's kind of the metric or the yardstick in which people measure the degree of people's achievements. There's an honest transactional nature to that. If you really buy into that system, you know you're buying into something which is quite tangible for sponsors or whatever to associate themselves with. But you can let that attitude dictate what you do and very much interfere with what you're inspired by and lead to quite an artificial relationship with your own motivation to climbing. But I don't think it has to be necessarily so black and white. With some introspection, reflection, there's definitely a way in which climbers can really learn to acknowledge what they are inspired by and intervene at points where they like become aware of the external factors influencing their actions, what they're trying, what they're like committing themselves to. You obviously have to be aware of it, but like, maybe I'm trying this for validation of people who I'll never meet. And actually, if I reflect on that, maybe this is something that's really important in my career right now. And maybe I will keep trying this project, but maybe actually this isn't what's making me happy. And I'm going to step away from it and see if I'm motivated by it in the future, that kind of thing. But it's quite a lot to ask. But I do think there is like a combined solution. I don't know, I think it necessarily has to be like fully opt out of this grading system or fully buy into it. That's my hope anyway.
Let's hope for that. Yeah, me too. And I'm not so in the scene anyway anymore, I think. But yeah, I think it would be beautiful, and everybody has to find his reason why he keeps on climbing and what motivates him. And even when you're motivated only by the grades, hopefully for this person it changes in the future, that he gets some other experiences in climbing that he loves it, or maybe change his mind. Let's see.
Would it also be an exciting trip for people who are really keen to do some of their own first ascents? Is there a lot of first ascent options still to go?
Yeah. It's huge. Like, we did a lot, but we just have been choking. Like, I have now my 16 sectors, I think. But potentially, this whole mountain is going to be one sector, because we are now in the luxury position. We only clean the best lines or what we think it looks good with the landing and all the stuff. So we just really pick out the best lines in every grade. Like, it doesn't matter if it's 5 or 6 or 7. We clean everything what is beautiful or what we think it's beautiful. And my friends did the same. Like, there was nothing there. So my friends who climbed 7A, they had to look for their 7A projects or rocks where they can climb. And even if we have 5As and 5Bs boulders there, it's really, you can actually start climbing in Rakshan if you want now, if it's in all levels. I think I missed the question now.
Yeah, no. You covered it. Talk about first ascent opportunities. I think there are first ascent opportunities.
Yeah. There is so much first ascent opportunities. I'm looking forward that people come, and I'm getting old and do my work and clean also some boulders that I can try in the future.
Yeah. You shouldn't have to clean every single boulder in the whole area.
Yeah. No, it's huge. It's really, the whole south side is untouched. Like, we started in the My friend did a lot of stuff there, but I didn't climb on the south side so much. But it's full of rocks. Like, I can send you some pictures once to see. Huh? And there are so many places in the valley. I did not even start. I just keep these places. If it's going to be too busy in Raksham, I just can go a few kilometers to another spot. And it's still full of rocks. And I did not even start cleaning there. Like, we tried to concentrate it all around Raksham, and there is still so much rocks in all these sectors yet. No, I think this is one of the biggest granite bouldering places in the world. I didn't see something else yet.
Wow. And we haven't actually really spoken about your own climbing in this area. How have you generally like approached your climbing days there? Because I wanted to talk about it. At one point, you developed the first try boulder, which was like quite an interesting, I thought it was an interesting example of where bouldering can go in terms of if this is one move, or like all the difficulty of the climb is in one move, and this is something you projected for many, many years, right? Mm-hmm. And so it would be interesting to hear your story with that boulder. But in general, I was thinking like how you approach a bouldering there. Like, are you mostly trying projects that are hard for you, and then in combination with that, on like days off, you maybe try like clean, easier ones, or like, do you go through phases? Or, well, actually, maybe first, could you talk about your development of first try? Because I thought this first is an interesting example of a boulder.
Yeah, first try was really a hard lesson to me. But when I found it, I found it was the most beautiful boulders I've ever seen. Like, when you stay in front of this rock, it's really hard to say something else. It's a little bit like karma, but I think it's from the setting and the rock and the shape and the holes, it's even better. It's so simple. You go there, you have the start hold, and you look up, you see this crimp. And when I found the rock, I was really in good shape for campusing and crimps. Like, I did this 1.49, and I thought, yeah, it's going to be easy. I'm going to do this problem quickly. So, but maybe then it kicked really my ass, and I tried 2-3 years, but it's only one move. And I didn't train at home. Like, I never really did that. I didn't make replicas. I always train at home, but more in the, also, I don't know how I train at home. I train very hard moves at home, but I'm not really making the boulders.
Yeah, so it's like general training.
Yeah, general training. And then I couldn't do it for a few years. But then I had my accident in 2015. So that took me. Well, actually, people told me I will never do sports. I will never do professional climbing again. So it took me 2 years to recover. So it added a little bit. Yeah, I don't know why what is so hard on this problem. I'm not a big person. And I was pretty good on that. I had to try it. It's like every time I passed this rock, I had to give it a few tries because it's just so beautiful. And I love to climb beautiful lines and boulders, but it was really getting epic. And at one point I gave it up. And then I hurt my shoulder 2 years ago again. And with kids climbing, I catch the kid, I ripped some tendons. And then I went to Raksham with a broken shoulder and thought, okay, I will not do much climbing this year. But then I noticed I can go straight climbing. Like, it's a campus move, and holding that didn't affect my shoulder. And then I just kept on jumping and jumping. And one day with Chibi Nibi, we did not expect it. I don't know what I made different on that day. Huh? It's a one move when you hit this crimp. It's a bit difficult to hit it at the right spot. It's a unregular crimp. And for probably, it seems like, for my size and for my body or my reach, it was really my limit. Nikki showed me that you can do it much quicker.
He's very good on big moves and on crimps as well, I think.
He's a very powerful person, and it's like just 20 centimeters more reach. So, and the jump is 120, 150 or something like that.
So wow, maybe it's a long way.
It felt so hard to me, but then I spotted Nicky and he just catched it and was dipped to the top very quickly. But yeah, I had the feeling this is the hardest move because I just tried so much. I for sure give it 1,000 tries and I don't know why I never...
Yeah.
Why it took so long.
Yeah, I mean, it takes incredible perseverance to try a boulder a lot, but trying a one-move boulder so much is another level of perseverance because there's very little feedback because it's very hard to know if you actually are close. Often, like when you're trying a hard boulder, you might have put many, many days into it, but you'll kind of only be putting more and more days in it because you know it's possible for you because it's like, well, I've done the moves. Probably it's possible kind of thing. But like, yeah, one move, it's, yeah, a hard one to stay motivated for, I'm sure.
That's, yeah. But maybe one of the reasons I keep on trying it, I had some beautiful experience in climbing. I hope they get even more in future. Like, I'm sure you have this too. Like it happens many times when I did high balls or like you are in this perfect state of whatsoever, like my mind is not here. And in these states, I did so crazy stuff for myself. And I know that's the reason I keep on trying because it's still possible to always enter this realm where there is no pressure, no nothing, just you and this rock and you just do it and you stick the hold. So I always believe in this magic moment it can happen. So I still have stuff from 2010 I try now. So I'm happy to show it to you one day you can climb all these projects. But yes, we have to push the Skyway project. I was close 5 years ago, but then a foothold broke and now I'm at the beginning again. It's a 1, 2, 3 mover. And I keep on trying until my body says, okay, I will not make it. But I believe in this perfect moment and that I can enter it anytime. It's not coming every time, but I'm training maybe for that. And then everything is possible. Like some of the high balls I did or some other stuff, it felt so easy when I did it then. Like I didn't feel a difficulty. Then you go back for photographing or try again and... it's hard to make the moves. So it's, did you ever have something like this too?
Or in the rare times where I have repeated climbs, having done them in the past, I'm often surprised by how hard they feel. If in myself, I look back and be like, oh, well, I'm now a better climber than I was there. And I'm like sure of this in terms of all the training I do on my board or like kind of feeling like technically I'm moving well, I'll be like very sure that I'm a better climber. And then like repeating climbs that I've done in the past, often it's to my surprise that they always feel harder than I anticipate they will.
Yeah, I don't try my hard boulders to climb it the second time. Sometimes for filming when I have to, but sometimes I did a boulder and I knew it was this moment and it will not happen again, maybe.
The message we got from Anders, who knows you and has also been to Rackham, was he was saying that you have to go back. It says, tell him to stop dancing around and properly finish Sugarfish. What's Sugarfish? What's the story there?
Sugarfish is the cringe project we have in Rackham right now. And I fell from the chuck last year, so... Then I told my friends, okay, I will put it in the guidebook. I don't want to try this again. I just write, I fell from the chuck. I did the crux and actually the move, I did campusing. I fell on that move when I came from the ground. So, and I couldn't do the start again.
Oh, no.
I did this move once. Yeah, and then fell at the end. So, but yeah, maybe he's right. I should go back and finish it. You would love it. Like Giuliano was also close on this boulder. It's only 1, 2, 3 hard moves, 80 plus maybe. And then this last move to the chuck. And maybe I tried this also since many years. I don't know why I fell there. It's actually pretty crazy.
Oh, no. It's amazing how easy it is to mess up easy moves when you've done hard moves before, much harder moves beforehand. It gets in your head.
You fall out of concentration, or maybe there was just this, I did it like inside, just a little ego thought or whatever. Or maybe I was really not afraid, but I was surprised reaching, I did the crux and then I thought I have it, and then I messed it up. Yeah, it always happens sometimes.
Did you feel like your motivation for the boulder was a bit reduced after that, though? Because you did all the hard bit and you just fell off the easy bit. Sometimes it's hard to get excited to do the whole thing again just to do the easy bit.
Yeah, and this year I found so many other crazy projects, so I got more stuck into my other projects, because every year I try this Sugarfish also. I tried it already with Giuliano 3 years ago, 4 years ago. I try every year, but this year I found other things and I just felt I was more attracted to the other boulders, or climbing new things gives me much more motivation sometimes. So I leave sometimes projects away. Or going back to Aiden's question a little bit, when I go to Rakshyam, I have mostly like 5-6 lines in my mind I want to try and climb, maybe 3 main. And this year it turned out I climbed a lot of other stuff, but not those things I actually drove there. but it was fun because we found a new sector and we found new lines. And so I was just more motivated to climb in the new sectors. And I had Anders and my friends there, so I had spotters and we had more crash pads. So I was really psyched to try other things. And Sugarfish, let's see if I give it another try next year. Some Indian climbers are training right now for the Sugarfish because they are training since 3 years only for that fucking boulder. And he's like a chibi-nibi, they get really strong. So maybe they can climb it and then they would be some of the strongest climbers of India, which they are anyway, like on crims, they are so super strong. And those guys only try this Sugarfish. It looks so simple, beautiful. And when you see the holes, you will love it. You need one pad. You don't even need a pad because the ground is flat and with leaves, one shape. It's amazing, actually. And we have many of those boulders. So I try a lot of things, actually, all the time. And on rest days, cleaning or easy climbing. And like I said at the beginning, when you clean something, you don't know if it's 7A. Roughly, you know if it's about 8A. But sometimes when it's a lot of moss or it's, you don't really know how difficult it is, but then it's still a beautiful 7A or 8A or 7C. I like to vary the climbing. Like, I like technical stuff. I did a lot of technical boulders in Rakshyam, I think, which was also interesting to see Nikki, because he did some of my hardest boulders he just did. Then I showed him some other lines where it didn't feel so hard to me, more technical. I said, but this is fucking hard. And so you see the experience from, it's so different to every person.
Hmm. Yeah.
You're more well known for first ascents, with the exception of Dreamtime. I think most of the things that you're associated with are first ascents. Do you ever put time into repeating things, or is it mostly first ascents that you're motivated for?
I'm mostly motivated for first ascents, but I'm trying these boulders in Switzerland. I wanted to repeat also some of the hard boulders, also to see where I am. All these new HCs and HC pluses they have in Ticino. Of course, I'm very curious how they look like and how the movements are. But it takes a lot of time to climb this stuff. So mostly I do the moves, I check the sequences. And this year I was really psyched to climb some of the hard boulders in Bavona. But you need some people, you need more crash pads. It's so complicated nowadays to repeat those hard boulders because you need 10 crash pads on some boulders. And so I thought, I go back to Rakshyam. I have so many cool projects I can do with 2 pads. But I checked really many boulders. And when I can do the sequences and I didn't finish them, but I know what other people's climbed. And yeah. Of course, I'm curious what other people are still doing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You have some references.
Yeah, and sometimes I'm just happy when I climb the sequences, or I know it would be my realm, or I can do it. Maybe in the future I still have time, but it's most big problem, not a problem. I'm a bit too lazy driving and organizing a few people, and some of the boulders you have to have 10 crash pads. I went to Bavona last year, super site to Nichutze and this Africa boulder, and I was feeling really strong, but with 3 pads and being alone there, you just do nothing.
Yeah.
A little bit at the start and feel. So maybe one day, but I still have enough own projects to finish, I think.
That's interesting, actually, because one of the questions we got for you from the Patreon was asking you, were there projects, you know, years back in Ticino that you were aware of that you had thought were impossible that are now done?
That maybe sounds really arrogant now, but I'm really waiting for the rock where I stay below and say, fuck, yeah, this could be. Hopefully the boys show us the next level of climbing soon. But now all the stuff, I either tried it, I had a look at it, I can still hang on the holds, I can still do the moves. No, not yet. I think I still have some projects in Ticino that are not done yet either. And I tried them 20 years ago. And Aiden, you tried this project in Schattental. Like I tried also 20 years with this undercling finger pocket with these super small holds. This is very futuristic. I will not do that. But when you do this, yeah, I tried a little. I spent a few days on this boulder too.
Yeah, no, I have spent quite some time under that boulder. In fact, I think I will return in middle of March. But yeah, I've tried it quite a lot. It's an interesting boulder.
A crazy top out also, but you find a nice sequence. How are you going to do there? That's amazing.
Yeah. It's an inspiring one for me. I think maybe at a similar stage to how you've described, at a point where I really have gone back to over not so many years, but I've spent a lot of time in Switzerland and I'm very like comfortable and familiar returning to these places and the projects which I've tried there, but have a bit of excitement for some more adventure in my climbing as well. So hopefully I can do both.
Yeah, good luck. And maybe I'm still here in the middle of March, so maybe I come by for a coffee or for a spot. I can give you a spot.
Oh, yeah, no, we can share some seconds. I can show you my sequence and you can see what you think.
A while back, Bandy, you referenced your training. What does training look like for you?
Nowadays, since my injury in 2015, back in the days, we did not really train. My training was really training on the boulders. I loved training on the rock, and we did not have training advisors. But since my accident, I got a little bit into the training, and also I don't have so much time anymore. So in the last years I played around, I have really strong fingers now. It seems like I'm 45 years and have the strongest fingers ever had, but the rest of the body, it's also okay. So I'm playing around. Like I know some in the Red Bull team, there are also other sportsmen. So the ski jumpers, these guys are doing really hard max power training. And I try to play around a little bit with this. So what I do now, I think we can't really fit into a regular training plan because maybe people will hurt themselves. But I just played around, like go really high intensity, which you can't do every day. You must really develop a little bit of feeling if your body is capable today. So I hang on small crimps, like normal things, what other people are also doing. Small crimps, weight. That's it, actually.
Is there anything that you've changed as you've got older that you've kind of maybe stopped doing or started doing?
Yeah, at the beginning when we started training, at the beginning we had just no much idea about training, and we thought a good training is when you are totally fucked afterwards. So it's so stupid what we did. I think nowadays, really, I go for super quality, like high intensity, really high quality. Maybe sometimes I train just half an hour, 20 minutes on my fingers or something else. And then next day I do another part of my body or something else. But yeah, no. And I'm older now, I need more rest. That's for sure. I take always 2-3 rest days. Like I need more rest days now, but I think it's important to go really for max power, like maximum power. And that's I'm still interested in, because small holds is max power. I think you just go, yeah, for quality. Like sometimes I hang on these 4 millimeter crimps, and some days I can hang without weights, and some days I can go there with 20 kilogram weight.
On 4 millimeter?
I can do 4 millimeter with 30 kilograms or something.
Whoa. That's a huge amount.
But it's more about getting over this pain, no? This pain in the finger. And the problem is actually the skin is not holding the pressure. Like my skin is ripping off. So I have to do this slowly.
Wow. Yeah, that sounds painful.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think some of the hard balls, it's more to get over this pain level that your fingers just, you grab it and you don't feel it, and then you just make the move.
Yeah, there is an element of like pain inhibition a lot of the time when you get really small holds.
Yeah, or that your fingers are getting used to this kind of small holds, or that these fingertips, maybe we kill some of the sensations of the fingertips. Yeah. This kind of training.
Yeah.
maybe we won't recommend that part of the training.
So this is this is finger training and a little bit lock-off training is the only thing I do now. And in Raksham, I have just so many bowlers. I prepare myself with these 2-3 exercises, I think. Body tension, but I always have good body tension. On my rest days, back in the days, I did always yoga. I tried that the body stays smooth, I think is very important. Nowadays, I see many people are so, what is the English word?
Like tense?
There's so much tension. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think it's really important that you don't have to do yoga, but you have to keep the body fluid, keep the moving easy, I think. So stretching and yoga really was always important for me. And I still think I'm 45 years old and I have no problems. My back is good, my shoulders. So maybe this was a good way of training I did in the back in the days.
Yes, well, we actually spoke to Neil Gresham very recently, about a week ago. It's not come out yet. And I think he's in his 50s now. And he said he hasn't been injured in 15 years. Since he got older, he stopped getting injured and says he feels really good. So I think that's interesting. I don't think it's necessarily a thing that as you get older, you get more injuries in climbing.
No, when you take care, your tendons should be fine. And when you just take care a little bit that you're not too crazy stuff when you're super tired. I had the same feeling, like my fingers, I was really surprised, or like this whole body feels. Last year, my injuries was by kids climbing or catching people by spotting. Like stupid little things, not from climbing.
Yeah, it's funny because what he was saying is by his age, he feels like his body is just so used to climbing that it just feels really natural at this point. He's so built for it.
And I think he was saying as well, he feels so attuned to his body, like listening to his body, which I'm still got a lot of learning to do about that. But I feel like even from when I was a teenager, I feel like a lot more responsible in listening to how my body has reacted to things. Yeah, like you say, when you're really tired, not training really hard and risking injuries and things, you become a bit more sensible.
I think it's important always when you try training and you work on the max power, you must be fresh and the feeling must be good. And because sometimes we have these training plans, but I was always flexible in this. I warmed up. sometimes. And when I didn't get the right response, I said, okay, it's not today. I wait another day. I do the training tomorrow then. Or maybe sometimes you get into it. But, and sometimes now when I do these trainings with these fingers and this weight, I feel right at the beginning, okay, today I can do it. My body is good. Go for it. And if it's not, I just leave it for the day or do something easy or something else. I think this is would be cool if as a young sportsman, you can learn that. Just keep, better make him one more rest day than get injured, maybe, I think. Or to get most out of it, that's important. Like one manager at Red Bull once told me, or a trainer at Red Bull looked at me and said, yeah, it's not about training, it's about resting.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And for sure, back in the days, we trained way too much and we had a wrong idea about training. I think nowadays they are really good and better. But still, every person is also different. I don't think that every training plan is good for every person.
Yeah. We've spoken a little bit about, just training now as well. We've made a few connections between like how climbing has changed over the years, and probably in the time when you've been at the within the elite of bouldering, like you've probably seen a lot of change as well. But I was wondering if you feel there are any many ways in which you see like the younger generations, how they interact between each other, and like maybe how that differs to when you were first getting into the scene. Do you see it change much?
I think like you think the top climbing scene or the climbers in general changes?
I was more thinking of like the top, or maybe the top climbers is unfair. But I was thinking of like the people developing areas into Chino in more recent years or in like Rocklands are often also the ones who are like climbing the hardest as well. I mean, obviously not universally, but I was thinking amongst like professional athletes, maybe.
From the outside, it looks actually really nice, like this how people go climbing together, and it seems like they also have to climb together because you need so many pads and the projects are so big.
So, it's a logistical convenience.
I also see like you come up with more ideas. Like we didn't have that. I had this with Fred, but I was only climbing with Fred most of the time. But we bouldered together on some projects, but I would never touch Fred's boulder, or I would never climb it before him or something like that. But this was just a very personal thing for me because I saw he was so psyched. Maybe we bouldered a little bit together to find another sequence or a trick or just to check the line. But then I was not motivated because it was like old style, this is Fred projects, I will not do this. And I was also not psyched. I did not climb the 7C project of my friends. When I see he's psyched on this boulder, he cleaned it, he brushed it, and he's totally in his 7C project, I'm not touching it and climbing it because I can do it. But I think the climbing scene now, it looks from the outside very chilled and relaxed, and it's cool that... I think this is also the reason there are so many hard boulders now, because the group is always together. You find so quickly so many good solutions. Like once I organized a Red Bull event and I invited many strong climbers to Galtür, and there was a boulder, like an 8B roof and a high vault top out. And I climbed it and I had two ideas about this boulder. And I thought, yeah, these are the two ways. Then in the afternoon, the whole crew, 15 people have been on this boulder. And I think we had 15 different variations or possibilities to climb this line. So it's really cool to see the strongest people climbing together, because you come up with so many more ideas. And I think it's easier to climb this stuff. You're psyched. The motivation in a group is always much bigger. You don't have the logistic problem. I think it's nice doing this stuff alone. I enjoyed it also doing it alone. Like I loved being just for myself, But then you need years for some of the boulders. When you are 3-4 people, maybe just do it in the afternoon or this month.
Yeah. No, it is true. And it's, time is a big factor. But like you say, motivation as well. It can be like quite inspiring to climb with others as well and share ideas. And it brings a social aspect of climbing into the experience, which maybe isn't there if you're climbing alone.
It brings a social aspect for sure. But I just a thought. Maybe many people need the group to be motivated also. I saw sometimes when you see people alone, they don't really know, but as soon as the group here and somebody makes a high point or whatever, there is this this feeling, this rush, this adrenaline in the air, and then everybody kicks into that. So I think it's good for hard climbing when the crew is together. Yeah, it makes it for sure easier.
Yeah. Oh, that's nice.
Should we do Desert Island Boulders?
Oh, yeah.
the boulders, yeah.
Desert Island Boulders. Did you get the format?
Yeah, I'm on an island and I can take 5 boulders with me.
Yes, you've washed up on an island. You can take 5 boulders. You don't have a rope, but the rock can be of any size. So technically you could take El Capitan, but you'd be soloing it.
It's not just a line. I could take the whole boulder. Like not a line of a boulder.
No, you have to choose. Rock. No, you have. Yeah, you take the rock, but you have to choose one line. So you can't. Okay. So you could take a boulder with loads of lines on it, but you have to choose one. Don't know. It's an arbitrary rule, that one, but I think it's to stop people from all taking the boulders with the most lines on. It's nice big sandy landings, so you don't have to worry about pads.
No logistical nightmares.
The conditions are good year round. But yeah, you can't leave the island because of shark infested waters.
Okay,
What boulders did you choose?
I wanted to check. I take the Johnny Dawes project he wanted to show me 10 years back.
Oh, wow. Oh,
wow.
I will write him once. It's written in one of my, I always have books when I travel, like a travel book. And in one of my books, he told me about the project in the grid he wanted to show me. So I thought that this would be on my list.
Oh, do you know, because Johnny Dawes, for those, I mean, I'm sure we have lots of British listeners that I'm sure will have heard about him, but he's infamous for quite a playful style as well and would often do incredibly difficult climbed without using his hands, so like was almost quite well known for climbing slabs and such things on the gritstone and moving really well without using his hands. So I'm interested to hear what type of thing he was trying to get you on to try, and I also wonder if he's done it.
we should send him a message afterwards. He just wrote me a few weeks back. Yeah, that would be really interesting. Maybe I can visit the UK one day. So the Johnny Dawes project, I thought, should be on the island. Then I take the Bengali wall from Raksham.
Oh,
there
nice.
Are many boulders on it, but push the Skyway project because I tried already 10 years, so maybe I can do it in the next years.
Yes, you got lots of time on the island.
Lots of time. What is still here? I'm not sure. I love to, always wanted to climb Finish Line or Living Large, actually. But Finish Line actually looks more, Finish Line would be nice.
Yes. Yeah, that's.
I think that's on someone's island already, isn't it?
One of the best looking lines one could ever ask for.
And then you have 1, 2. I didn't climb the Bügeleisen. But the Bügeleisen is really an amazing piece of rock in Austria. It's also another boulder, actually. But Clem Losko did the stand start. So
fantastic. That's on my island as well. Good choice.
That's one that Sam's often referenced wanting to try.
Yeah, that's really beautiful. And I have a highball also from Raksham. Maybe when it's on the island and it's a sandy landing. I sent you a picture. That's the most stunning highball I've ever found. But yeah, with one bolt, it would be safe and you are alive. But when you fall on that one, you probably, yeah, you will have a problem.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yes.
Back in the days, I called it the fear project. It's possible, like the stand. I did the hardest part. It's a 8A, but then it goes up another 8 meters. And it's like, do you know Le Angle de Parfait in Fontainebleau, like this?
Yeah.
Yeah, and this would be the top out of my 8A boulder then. It's like four moves like Le Angle de Parfait, but you are very, very high above the ground already.
Wow. And so you can't fall off at that point and you've got to do something like L'Angle Parfait.
Yeah, with 15 or 20 crash pads from Magic Wood, you probably can make it. But I only have 3-4 pads there. And I'm not sure if carrying 20 pads there, then I make it as a top row.
Yeah, okay.
It's kind of more, it's closer to climbing. And because 20 crash pads carrying there, I could probably get the logistic in India. People would help me. But maybe I just do it as a top rope then. And yeah, what would be, how many I have now?
I think that's five, isn't it? Is that?
That was five. The Bügeleisen, the Johnny Dawes project, the finish line, the Bengali ball.
And your high ball.
And your high ball, yes.
And a high ball, yeah.
Yeah, so that'll keep you busy for a while.
Yeah.
Wow, it's nice to hear that Raksham almost made your entire list of boulder problems. It's nice. And a mystery UK line made it on there.
Yeah, that would be really interesting. I'm looking through my travel books to see if I have more information on this. My High Fidelity was also on the list because it's such an amazing line in Cayley.
Oh, but, yeah,
then,
yeah.
Then I thought this Johnny Dawes project must be very interesting.
It's really cool to see British boulders turning up on this island. I don't think we took really any British boulders, did we?
No, yeah, but gritstone is really amazing. No, I like the gritstone, the climbing. It's really amazing rock you have up there.
Yeah, it's nice to hear because we often don't like get so, or maybe historically in the past we have, but in more recent years, there's an idea we don't get so many international visitors. So it's nice to hear that you've spent some time here. And also Nikki is another person who's visited in more recent years and climbed some of the classic, like in York, like High Fidelity. He did a lot of, he had a trip where he was in Yorkshire and the Peak District. And then last year was in exploring Northumberland quite a lot.
Wow. No, I will come back to the UK for sure one day, maybe just climb easier classics or whatever, but there's amazing rocks.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
there's
that'd
a lot
be great.
A lot to find as well, especially in Scotland. I know there's a lot to be developed. So,
yeah, I have a grid block here.
Oh, nice.
Dave Parry would be, Dave Parry would like to see that.
Yeah.
Overview.
Yeah.
I just like it, the friction and the texture of this climbing up there is really unique. This you don't really find somewhere else in the world. And when you have good friction or like this smiling buttress, I tried also.
Oh, nice.
Long time ago. Like when you are living there and you would have the friction or the time, it's an amazing, interesting little piece.
Still only seen one ascent. All these years later, yeah.
Wow. The first ascent by Ty,
and still unrepeated since.
Yeah.
So some years now, I think, yeah. But you need to have the friction, and it would be good to live there for some time. I think that you can do things like this.
Yeah, I think it's fickle conditions which makes it, much easier to be local, because. Yeah. You get only a few good days and the rest of the time you can be training. But if you were trying to organize a trip, you could easily come for 2 weeks and get no good days.
Yeah. So that will not happen when you come to Raksham one day in fall season. I can guarantee you normally if the climate is collapsing in the next years, so let's see. But
well, fingers crossed. Yeah, we can. We really hope for that.
I think it's already changed a lot. So, but there was no snow in the Himalayas since 2 years. Now they got some snow in March or in end of February. They got the first snow in the Himalayas.
Oh wow! And that's new for in the last few years.
Yeah. This is now since 2-3 years. Yeah, that's pretty crazy. Actually, like I climbed in the Himalayas till 20th of December. And in 2010, 11, 12, we leave the Himalayas in November because it was too cold and winter came.
Okay.
So it's crazy. Good for climbing, but for the rest, I'm not sure.
Yeah. Complex.
It's wild, the speed of it, isn't it? It's literally happening in front of our eyes, but yeah, scary.
It's a scary. Yeah, we've seen it coming since many years. I studied that shit 20 years ago. So that's scary to see that 20 years later, suddenly it's a little bit a topic in the media and a theme people talk about. But when I studied 20 years ago on university and I was reading studies from the 1960s and 50s where it's pretty good explained in which direction it can go. So it's really crazy that it's totally disappeared and we don't have a climate problem in the media.
Yeah. There was some pretty shocking predictions in like the 1980s, which were like, pretty well researched and well understood. So it's, crazy that it's taken so long to be too seriously acknowledged.
To finally do something. Yeah, let's, but we can still hope for the best and be nice
and enjoy some lovely weather in December.
it's like that. We can enjoy climbing in December in the Himalayas now.
Oh, fantastic. We try and keep these podcasts to about 2 hours, so I think that's a really good place to wrap up. But I just massive thanks really for coming on, and it was great to hear from you.
Thank you for the invitation, Sam and Aidan. It was really cool to have a talk with you.
Thank you so much for joining us. It's been really motivating to hear you talk about your climbing, and I'd love to read the India at some point, and you'll be the first person I'll get in touch with.
Just let me know, or when you are in Ticino and you need a spot, well, maybe also go back. I tried your boulder in Brioni a little bit, but now it's raining in Ticino anyway.
I heard actually the forecast, the weather's been pretty bad.
It's time to go to sleep for me, and I wish you a good night too.
Thank you so much for joining us, and
bye. Thank you very much.
See ya. Bye. Thanks.
Bye.